weird way to be doing this, and can't really even see anybody's faces. I guess it makes it easier for everyone to sleep, and also easier for everyone. If you're going to be distracted, this is a beautiful place to be distracted. It's like going to a planetarium. You can look at the stars, and you can enjoy yourself very much with that. We're going to try to talk about some really serious things tonight. Tonight, even though there were sweeps around the dorm, and then we certainly encouraged and expected everyone's participation throughout the night, there was something nice about the fact that you had shiurim, almost every single one of which was standing room only, big crowds of people that were there, and people who want to really explore some challenging and difficult ideas were able to do so, and people who didn't, and that's okay, and that's going to go through for the next few minutes that we have out here also. Like I said, if you want to take a nap in the dark, if you want to take a look at the stars, if you want to just enjoy being outside, you certainly can do so, and if you want to think about a couple of ideas or two and challenge yourselves, if we want to challenge ourselves, I should say, then we're going to have an opportunity to do that also. Because what we're going to speak about is something which is really important and not really simple. The answers, the questions might be better than the answers. The questions might be more interesting than the answers. The answers are going to be something that we're going to begin to work on tonight and hopefully continue to work on for a very, very, very long time to come. In 1995, the Best Picture Award, Academy Award, the Oscar for Best Picture, went to a movie that I'm sure many of you have seen, although I'm also sure that not all of you have seen, a movie called Braveheart. It was before Mel Gibson was accused of being an anti-Semite, so Jews were safe going to see Mel Gibson's movies, and Braveheart won the Academy Award. Braveheart is described now, whether it's an IMDb or just on a Google search or Wikipedia page, as an epic story of medieval Scottish history. So you might imagine that when the movie came out and people were like tonight, what the Shira is going to be about, what's that movie going to be about? And the answer was, you'd look up in the newspaper, you check on the internet, which was just beginning then, and they'd say it's an epic story about medieval Scottish history. So not everybody, certainly not every teenager or 20-something in America, was running to see Braveheart. That was a mistake, because Braveheart is an immensely popular movie. It's not an artsy movie. In fact, it was labeled by certain newspapers and movie critics as the least accurate historical movie in the history of Hollywood and the history of movies. They made up virtually everything that happened in it, and there was almost no truth to any parts of it whatsoever, not the oppression of the English and not the fighting of the Scots and not who the people were and not even who William Wallace was or what they were. It's basically a Hollywood movie like all the others, like Gladiator, like The Patriot, like any other movie that Mel Gibson or Russell Crowe might be in, about a person who's being oppressed and a person who's trying to fight for his freedom. But it's really, really interesting. It's really, really exciting, and it's really it's a fun movie, and it's a long movie. And you could see why it won the Academy Award, because people think they're learning history when, in fact, they're just watching any other Disney-fied Hollywood movie about an underdog beating an oppressor and gaining his freedom. I'm not going to give away anything from the end of the movie in case anybody after that introduction wants to see it, maybe tonight when you're not supposed to. But if anybody is planning on doing it, I won't give away all the endings of it. But there is a climactic moment towards the middle of the movie, and it really speaks to... It really speaks to the question that we're going to deal with tonight. I'll read it to you because I want to get it right. There's a scene where the Scotsman, who William Wallace is representing and fighting for, the people of Scotland are about to face, they're vastly outnumbered by the mighty British army, which is organized and has all the weaponry in the world, and this band of ragtag Scotsmen have an opportunity to fight against the British, and they're going to do it. And they come face to face with the British enemy, and they get very, very intimidated, and they get very scared. So William Wallace tries to rally them, and he says to them, "What do you want to do? Do you think we're going to fight?" And I'm reading now, this is the direct quote, one of the army people, one of the Scotsmen says, "Fight against that? No, we will run and we will live." And William Wallace gives the following response. Again, it's probably the most important speech in the movie, the best, doesn't give away anything from the plot or what happens. And he says, "Aye," which is Scottish for yes, I guess, "fight and you may die. Run and you'll live, at least a while. And dying in your beds many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that? Would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that? For one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom." It's one of the best psych-up speeches in the history of American film. It's one of the best psych-up speeches in the history of all movies. William Wallace's speech, they'll never take our freedom. We may die on the battlefield, you'll live, but what's life worth living if you do not have freedom? There is a major point of conflict, and we're going to talk about this question on two different levels, and I hope, like I said, you pay attention at least to the questions, because even if you fall asleep before we get to the answers, so you could spend the rest of your life trying to follow the word of God and trying to follow Judaism, authentic Judaism, the way it was meant to be, and try to answer the question. Let's try to, like I said, at the very least, let's try to understand the question as well as possible. The question is true on two levels. Virtually every value, and many of you may have heard Rutorsky earlier tonight speaking about the effects of culture on our society and our lives, virtually every value that we have been taught preaches to us the supreme importance of freedom. Freedom is not just something we crave. They talk about the American way being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Pursuit of happiness may or may not be a value. You've heard Shiurim about that in your lives, discussions about that in your life. Is being happy and pursuing happiness as an end to in itself, is that a value in our society? Is that a value in our world? But freedom, unquestionably, is a desire, is a value in our world. When William Wallace makes that speech, they can take our lives, but they can never take our freedom. You jump out of your seat in the movie theater or on your couch at home, and you want to fight for Scotland. You've never watched a Disney movie, not the Mighty Ducks and not Little Giants, where you were rooting for the underdog as much as you were rooting for the people of Scotland. In fact, when I was finally convinced to see this movie in the theaters, and I was with a friend of mine, who happens to be a pretty funny guy, and we were walking out, and we were all totally charged up by this movie. It was so inspiring and so uplifting, and he was a little bit down. He was depressed. So we said to him, why are you down? Why are you depressed? You usually get excited about this sort of thing. And he said, I just feel bad that I'm not Scottish. Like, I wanted to be Scottish. Like, I want to go, like, kill some English people. You know, no offense to the English people, but, like, I'm not Scottish, so it's not really my fight. And I don't really know what to do with the movie right now. Don't really know how it's supposed to inspire me because I'm not Scottish. When he gives that speech, they can take our lives but not take our freedom. So you don't have to be Scottish to understand that there's a point of inspiration and there's an unbelievable value being stated there. The United States of America is founded on, and again, you may come from Canada, you may live in Israel right now, but you definitely appreciate and understand the values that are expressed in the United States of America. The United States of America is founded on the Declaration of Independence. That's what makes America great. July 4th, which is the founding of the country, is Independence Day. If you think that these things don't affect the way we think and the way we are, I mean, we're probably not paying that much attention. We are the land of the free, the home of the free, the land of the brave, land of the free, the home of the brave. That's not just the end of the Star Spangled Banner. It's not just the end of the national anthem. That's a value. When America, when North America, when the Western world lives up to as great as it can be, it's a place that puts a premium on and values supreme independence over everything else. Rav Moshe Weinberger explains very, very beautifully, and we're going to talk, God willing, a lot of Torah in the next few minutes, so listen to it as carefully as possible because it's important. We know that nothing that we read about in Tanakh, nothing that we read about in Torah is a coincidence. Nothing is just there because it happens to be there. Things are there for a reason. So if you were ranking the chata'im, the sins that we read about in the Torah, there's no question that cheta egel, cheta meraglim, those are definitely up there. But probably number one on the list is the cheta of Adam and Chava. This is in Christianity and their thought, what we refer to as original sin. It is the basis of every sin that man commits going forward. Christianity got that, of course, from the Old Testament, from our Chumash. That's why they believe it in as much as they do, and that's why they put such an emphasis on it. And you don't need to believe in Christianity to understand the significance of the sin of Adam and Chava. So what was the sin of Adam and Chava? Obviously, on a certain level, the sin of Adam and Chava was not listening to the word of God. And it almost doesn't matter what form that took of not listening to God. God said to do something or not to do something, and they defied the word of God. They rebelled against the word of God in a very, very significant way. You're not supposed to do that. That's a chet, that's a sin. And again, the details of the tree and the apple are almost insignificant. But of course, we don't believe that anything is insignificant. And even if you believe that some things are insignificant, which we don't, you certainly don't believe that the story, the first story in the Torah of man's first sin and man's first rebellion against God, it's really hard to believe that such a central detail, like the apple and like the tree, would be anything but very significant. And Rav Weinberger, quoting from the Gedolei Chassidus, explains very beautifully and very correctly, original sin was the original sin. That's not a Christian thought. It's the source of all sin that everybody does. What is the act of detaching an apple? Why was that the sin of taking an apple off of the tree, of detaching an apple from a tree? Because every living creature, you don't need to grow up in America. You don't need to study the Star Spangled Banner. You don't need to watch Mel Gibson portraying William Wallace in Braveheart to understand that every living thing, from the moment it's born, has an inclination and a drive towards independence. It exists. What happens when an apple grows? So you could be distracted by all the beauty of a bright, shiny apple and the beautiful food and fruit that is being created on top of a tree. And of course, those who are lucky enough to go on the food teal tomorrow, so you're going to see some of that in action. Growth and beauty and nature and the fruits of Eretz Yisrael in the most spectacular of ways. But there's also something else that's going on simultaneously and significantly. Every fruit that ever grows is building for itself independence. Because when it is inside the tree, when it's a little bit of sap, a little bit of a seedling, when it's the tiniest of blossoms, it's rock solid on a tree. You ever try to detach, even here in Beit Meir, a pine cone before it's overly ripe? I don't know if you could use the word ripe for a pine cone, but whatever a pine cone is, when it becomes a little bit discolored and a little bit less connected to the tree, when you have that at its early stages, I mean, you need a pair of scissors. You need garden shears. You need an axe to separate it from where it is. Certainly when it's inside the tree, it's inseparable from the tree. But the juiciest, reddest, most delicious apple in the world is falling off without any effort from the farmer, without any effort from the gardener. It's basically falling off on its own. We're hurtling. We're speeding towards that level of independence. That's what we crave and what we desire. And of course, sadly, and this is where the question part might begin to come in, of course, sadly, that independence is synonymous with death. That independence is the same thing. Once you are a fruit and you become detached from your life source, then you are starting a new cycle of development where you are still speeding towards something, but instead of speeding towards independence, you're speeding towards decay and you're speeding towards ruin. So how do we reconcile this? How do we hold, as North American Jews, as people who live in the Western world, how do we have, on the one hand, a particular set of values that value this idea of freedom, this value of independence? It's not just the Declaration of Independence. America wanted to escape tyranny. America is a story. That's why they made the Patriot shortly after they made Braveheart. America is a place where they tried to say there is going to be no tyranny. There's going to be something called democracy. And more important than anything else, there's going to be something called liberty and freedom. How do we reconcile that with our Jewish identity, with our allegiance to our halacha, to the shiurim that you heard earlier tonight, some of you, from Rabbi Savolovsky about kibud av v'eim, from Rabbi Turetsky about listening to rabbanan and listening to rabbis? Why don't I figure out, why don't I do what feels right to me? Why don't I do what feels good to me? And I don't mean in a desiring way. I don't mean I'm going to eat a cheeseburger because a cheeseburger tastes good. But why don't I make my own decisions, and why don't I subscribe to the almighty value of freedom instead of, in order to be an Orthodox Jew, giving up some of that freedom and having allegiance to something else? The question gets worse and the question gets stronger, because maybe you don't care about American history and maybe you don't care about Braveheart. Maybe we just care about our own lives in school, in high school, in environments like this on NCSY Kollel. So I'm going to use two different words to frame the question on the second level of the question. And if the first part of the question didn't bother you and you're not really disturbed or gripped by the conflict that exists between the value of freedom in an Orthodox lifestyle that has complete and total allegiance to halacha, I can promise you that the second question will grip you. And the two examples we'll give in the second question are two very, very, very dirty words. Very dirty words. One of them, again, in a somewhat historical context, and one of them in the most basic context, something that nobody here wants to be. If you were accused of being it, it would be really one of the worst insults that a person would have. If you get back from a summer in NCSY Colo, and you're walking through the hallway of your school, and somebody says, ah, you went to NCSY Colo, you are, or you were blank, and I'll fill in the blank in a minute, you would be horrified. You'd be incredibly defensive, and you wouldn't want to do it at all. Let's fill in the blank right now. The blank in that is you were brainwashed. You don't make your own decisions. You were manipulated. You went to a place, NCSY is a cult, NCSY Colo is a super cult. You listen to certain people. You're not making up your own mind. You're not making your own decisions. You don't have your own values. Somebody is imposing values and a lifestyle on you. Maybe those people are charismatic. Maybe those people have a way of words. Maybe those people are super cool and are great role models. But whatever reason, you're brainwashed. You've been brainwashed as a person. There's nobody sitting here at that great Super Bowl commercial a few years ago for one of the job agencies where it had all the little kids talking about they want to be a failure, they want to be a kiss-up, they want to be an employee who does. Nobody aspires here. We can't film a commercial of anybody who says a beautiful Friday afternoon video sent to your parents' NCSY summer programs, yay, I got brainwashed. I want to be brainwashed. I aspire to be brainwashed. We're all horrified by the notion of being brainwashed. So we need to come up with a definition of what brainwash mean. What does it mean to brainwash a person? And isn't somebody telling you what to do, even if you don't understand it? And isn't somebody telling you what to think, even if you don't think it, and even if you don't believe it? Isn't that the ultimate definition of being brainwashed? Don't we have a right to be convinced of the authenticity and of the importance and beauty of Judaism before we follow anything? So therefore, I should make up my mind, and I owe allegiance to absolutely nothing by myself. Otherwise, I might be brainwashed. Let's give an even more dramatic example. And again, this too will horrify you. This too is something that nobody wants to do. Imagine that you are the judge and jury in whatever scenario for one of the last remaining horrible villains of the Holocaust. Imagine that you have the opportunity to pass judgment, maybe because he's your neighbor, or maybe because professionally you're a judge who's working. I often quote, there's an organization, they're running out of things to do because there are few survivors and fewer oppressors. Many of the survivors that are alive today from the Holocaust were young children at the time of the Holocaust, whereas if you were working as a guard or as an executioner or anything of that nature, odds are you're either dead or dying as we speak right now. There are not many. The United States government has a very, very holy and special organization. It's a branch of the Justice Department called the Office of Special Investigations. They exist. There were movies made about what they do. They exist to find people who lied on their entry visa in the late 40s and early 50s to come into America under false pretenses. They said they were farmers in the war when really they were working as guards in the concentration camp. So imagine this happens to one of your neighbors as a nice old man who you've always said hello to and delivered the newspaper to. And it comes out that he always had a little bit of a funny semi-Yiddish accent. You knew maybe he was German, maybe he has a German name, anything like that. And it comes out. Someday there's a knock on the door and there's a big controversy and it's front page news in the local paper. Maybe it's front page news in the New York Times. Turns out he was a horrible, horrible Nazi commandant in the time of the war. And he gives you as a defense, you can't, it doesn't sit well with you because he's a nice guy and he's a good man and he's been a part of the neighborhood for a long time. So you knock on the door one time and you say, I need to have a conversation. I need to understand what happened. And he gives you what has been. This is a psychological term, not just a historical one, because it was such a prevalent idea. He says, you have to understand. I did a lot of horrible things. I'm not proud of them. I feel bad. I regret them. I wish I hadn't done them. But you know the phrase. You've heard it in your life. All I was doing was following orders. I was just following orders. I was a good German citizen. I was a good German soldier. I was not the architect of the Holocaust. I did not come up with the idea to kill Jews. I was a member of an army. I was a member of a society. And these were the instructions we were given. Would you accept that for a minute as an excuse? Does just following orders make sense on any level whatsoever? Is that something which a person would be proud of? Is that something that a person could say is justifies any of these horrific behaviors, any of these horrific acts? So I would imagine that the answer is no. I can't see on your faces right now how many are nodding their head in agreement, how many have their eyes lit up and understanding the extent of the problem, but just following orders is not a way to live life. So how is just following orders a way of being halacha? How is just following orders and telling what to do? I should be able to. That's what we mean in the title of tonight's discussion when we say I should be able to do whatever I want. I don't think there's anybody suggesting here who's going to make the moral or philosophical case for doing whatever I want, which means I can hurt people or I can follow my heart's desire whenever I want. But we're asking a better question. We're asking on both of these levels, why isn't freedom, intellectual freedom, why isn't freedom to do the things that I feel are right and I think are good, why isn't that a supreme value? Why don't we look at halacha and why don't we look chas v'shalom at our gedolim and our rabbanim and our parents as being tyrants and as being people who interfere in our need, if we're going to be great people, to be independent, like the apple falling off the tree in Rav Weinberger's explanation? Why don't we do that? And what justifies any of our halachic behavior? Why aren't we, when we go to out into the big world, into the workforce, into a secular university, or any other opportunities to act with other people, what's our answer when they say that we're you went to a religious school, so you must be brainwashed. You went to NCSY Kollel or an NCSY Shabbaton, you must be brainwashed. What's our answer? We deserve to have an answer for that. We need to have an answer for that. We're going to try to understand it in the next couple of minutes. There's almost a non sequitur in Parshas B'Shalach. There's a fascinating story. It's fascinating for a million and one reasons. But in Parshas B'Shalach, right after the Jewish people leave Mitzrayim and experience the wonders of Kriyas Yamsuf, they get very, very thirsty. They get to a place called Marah, and yet another miracle takes place. We could talk about this for many hours. We're not going to, because there's one point which, like I said in the introduction a second ago, it's really a non sequitur in the Pasuk. The Jewish people complain. Moshe says to God, they kind of have a point. There is no water to drink here. We're in the middle of a desert. It's a significant problem. All there is this well or this spring of bitter water. God says, throw a tree into the water. The water will become sweet. These are not midrashim. These are psukim and parashas b'shalach. And that's what happens. Right after that happens, not the next story, inside that story itself, the Torah describes Moshe Rabbeinu's actions. It describes the fact that he threw a tree into the water. And then the Torah says the words, Sham sam lo choku mishpat v'sham nisahu. Instead of limiting the description to the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu throws the tree and miraculously the bitter water becomes sweet, so the Torah adds a phrase, which like I said is almost Latin, non sequitur. It means it has absolutely no place or connection with anything else. There, Moshe placed before them, Chok u'mishpat v'sham nisahu. There Moshe taught them laws. Most of you are probably familiar with the fact that based on this pasuk, there is a tradition that in Mara there was a description of certain critical laws. Rashi, of course, wants to know, what did they study and what did they learn in Mara? We won't be able to talk, we're not going to have time to explain how the non sequitur works, about what the connection is between this and the water, the bitter water and the sweet water. There is one, and we could have that conversation a different time. But Rashi makes a comment about what these laws are that they learned in Mara. Rashi says that they learned certain dinim, certain civil laws about how to interact with each other. Rashi says that they learned a little bit about Shabbos right there at that moment. It was important to learn about Shabbos, and that's fascinating in its own right. And Rashi says something which is a little bit bizarre. Rashi says they also learned at that moment the very, very cryptic and difficult to understand laws of Para Aduma, of the laws of Para Aduma. There is a commentary, a very important commentary, on the Torah. After compiling all of the Gemaras and every Pasuk in Chumash, there is a commentary called the Torah Tamima, and the Torah Tamima often gives explanations or background on all of these statements of Chazal. And the Torah Tamima has an extraordinarily difficult time with this Rashi. Why on earth? Dinim, civil laws, you're just left Mitzrayim, this is your first journey, there need to be rules about how you get on the bus, who you sit next to, who's entitled to what seat, whether the air conditioner is high or whether the air conditioner is low. You can't really function without basic laws that govern your behavior in a society with thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. So dinim makes sense, says the Torah Tamima. Shabbos, Shabbos, there's never really a bad time to learn about Shabbos. Shabbos is basic, and Shabbos is fundamental, and Shabbos is true. But the Torah to me says, I've tried very hard not to understand Parah Aduma, that I've given up already on, the red heifer, and Mentami, the Tahorim, and Mentara, the Tameh. I'm not going to understand Parah Aduma, but I've tried to figure out why on earth anybody would believe that sitting there in Mara, Moshe said, I'm now going to teach you one of the most difficult and obscure laws of the Torah, namely the laws of Parah Aduma. Why would a person ever do that? And the Torah Tamima, this is one of the most famous comments of the Torah Tamima in his entire five volumes of commentary on all of these drushos of Chazal, all of these words of Chazal. The Torah Tamima claims, very creatively, the Torah Tamima claims it's a mistake. The Torah Tamima, it's very rare for a later, the Torah Tamima was in the 1800s, it's very rare for a commentator on the Chumash to refer to something you'd find in a Rashi, which is based on a Medrash, and say it's an error. We generally speaking do not like to do that. We're very reluctant to make such a claim. The Torah Tamima says it's a mistake, and he says, I'll tell you how it happened to be a mistake. He says that once upon a time, Rashi wrote in Rashi Tevos, Rashi wrote in abbreviations, and the mitzvah that Rashi was referring to was Kibud Av V'Em. A lot of you just heard, as I referred to before, Rabbi Savolovsky, Kibud Av V'Em is in the Aseres HaDibros. Kibud Av V'Em is non-negotiable. Kibud Av V'Em is a building block, three partners in God, and Hakaras HaTov, and all of the other great and important reasons, many of which Rabbi Savolovsky articulated just a few moments ago. Kibud Av V'Em, I could hear, that is a justified mitzvah for why you would learn that in Mara. And once upon a time, it was written as Chaf, quotation marks, Aleph, Kibud Av V'Em. And later on, there was somebody reprinting Rashi, and this guy made two mistakes. His first mistake was, I'm going to make it easier on every high school guy who's studying for a test. I'm going to take away all the abbreviations. So let me spell things out. And his second mistake was confusing the Chaf for a Pei, because those letters look similar. So the Torah Tamima actually says, you can look it up in 20 minutes if you'd like, in our base medrash, the Torah Tamima says, there's no way that they learned about Parah Aduma in Mara. They definitely learned about Kibud Av V'Em. And then at the end, the Torah Tamima writes, and he says, it's a little bit weird that I'm the first one to figure this out. And he says specifically that if you look in the Ramban, if you look at his commentary, he quotes explicitly Parah Aduma in the name of Rashi. He also spells it out. So he says, I don't know why people through the years have accepted the fact that this version of Rashi of Parah Aduma is really correct. So I'm not the Torah Tamima. I can't tell you that the Torah Tamima is wrong, even when the Torah Tamima is saying that Rashi that we have is a misprint. But I'm not sure it's so impossible, and neither will you be so sure it's so impossible, that the mitzvah they studied in Mara, when they were learning about God and discovering about what Judaism was all about, I'm not sure that Parah Aduma was out of the question. And the reason why I'm not sure of it is because we're now still in the period shortly after the death of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's Zatzal. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, as many of you may have read about or heard about in the time after his death and the various Hespedim, he had a very special relationship that Rav Tarrigan described earlier this summer, and a very special relationship with high school guys in particular, with NZSY Kollel, even more in particular, very special relationship with young people who were interested in growing and interested in learning. On NCSY Kollel and other NCSY environments, I've had many opportunities over the years to hear of Aaron Lichtenstein have a question and answer session with guys just like the guys who are sitting here right now. And on more than one occasion, I heard a very interesting question posed to Aaron Lichtenstein. Let's say I haven't been a perfect Jew. Maybe I didn't grow up in an Orthodox home, or maybe, again, it's dark here, so no one has to look around, or no one has to nod in approval or agreement to this as well, but maybe I grew up in a very Orthodox home, and I was still far from a perfect Jew. I did a lot of chatam, I wasn't doing anywhere near the things I was supposed to be doing, and I was doing plenty of things I shouldn't be doing. So how do I start and how do I begin? How do I give a person the introduction that they need to have if they want to understand what Judaism is about? I'm not going to jump into the deep end of the pool. I can't commit myself to all 613. So what's the mitzvah? Where do I start if I want to do something, if I want to understand what Judaism is about? And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zatzal, invariably gave the same answer to that question. I heard it from him on at least three different occasions, not all on NCSY Kollel, on at least three different occasions, the same or similar question, and the identical answer that he gave. He held up his hands and he said, it's impossible. There is no one mitzvah that encapsulates Judaism. No one mitzvah that tells you what it means to be an Eved Hashem, what it means to be a growing person in His service of God. No one mitzvah. Now at this point you roll your eyes and you're like, you have to do 613, you have to do all. But here's where Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and his genius surprises you. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says there's no one mitzvah, you have to choose at least two. You don't have to choose three, you don't have to choose six, you don't have to choose 613, but you have to choose at least two. What are the two you have to choose? So he says, it's like, he doesn't use this analogy, but it's like a lunch special in a Chinese restaurant. There's column A and there's column B. You got to choose something from column A and you got to choose something from column B. Column A is a mitzvah that speaks to you. It's a mitzvah that excites you. You want to define Judaism by Shabbos. You want to define Judaism by prayer. You want to define Judaism by tzedakah or by chesed. Then you take upon yourself to follow to the greatest extent that you can this particular mitzvah that speaks to you and excites you. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein then explains, if your Judaism is defined by the mitzvah or mitzvos that excite you and inspire you, you will be practicing a failed Judaism. Because column B, as I'm sure most of you have guessed already, column B needs to be the opposite. You find the mitzvah that makes no sense to you. You find the mitzvah that you don't really understand. You find the mitzvah that doesn't speak to you and doesn't inspire you, and you do that mitzvah as well. If you begin with the building blocks of column A and column B, you will be a great Eved Hashem. That's Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's bracha. If you choose one or the other, if you have a Judaism that is completely robotic, if you don't try to be inspired or excited by so many of the simanim of Shulchan Aruch that speak to us about how to live a meaningful life, a productive life, a healthy life, how to relate to our children, to our community, to our friends, to ourselves in a more beautiful and inspiring way, your Judaism will be a disaster. But if all you do is pick and choose the things that make perfect sense to you and don't realize that part of this world of Orthodox Judaism has to do with allegiance to a God who is smarter than us, who knows more than us, and we give of ourselves to have a relationship and give ourselves over to the authority of God. So then Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says, not only is that a failed Judaism, but it borders on something else. It borders on the fact, which is of course in our generation a very, very real fear and a very strong reality. It borders on the fact that you're not worshiping God. You don't serve God. You don't believe in God. You believe in yourself. We believe in ourselves. The ultimate arbiter of the things that I do and the reasons why I do them is me and me alone, then I'm serving myself. Sometimes God does a good job and I'm like proud of God. That's the way, isn't it true? And again, I'm so happy that we're out here in the dark so I don't have to be looking anybody in the eye when I say this. But there's a lot of times where you're like, well, God, that, you did a phenomenal job with that mitzvah. Like actually, you know, it's like God has to prove himself to us in a meaningful way like that. Like we applaud Shabbos at a certain point. I get it now. You know what, God? I used to think you were nuts with this whole Shabbos thing, but come to think of it, you're pretty good. That's like the highest accolade that any of us could ever give for Judaism. It's also Avodah Zarah. It also means that we are the ones who make all the determinations. We are the ones. We're worshiping ourselves. And last I checked, none of us are gods. I want to share with you a Torah that is incredibly deep. Some of you may have heard it from me before, but all of you need to hear it and understand it. In fact, I often quote this in introduction whenever I share this idea from Rav Steinsaltz. It's an idea which I once shared with a group of students, and one of those students, who I'm close with to this day, embarked on a very, very long, arduous journey in and out of traditional Judaism. He really was fighting the good fight and struggling mightily and had a lot of ups and a lot of downs. I have a world of respect for him. I don't have agreement with all of his decisions in life. And on more than one occasion, he has told me, as recently as a few months ago, that it is this Torah that I'm about to share with you that keeps him connected to Judaism, that keeps him focused on anything close to the traditional orthodoxy that we practice, that keeps him grounded in halacha, that keeps him going to shul, that keeps him keeping Shabbos, just the strength of this very, very simple idea. Chazal tell us in a number of places around the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim that many of the Makos and the Karban Pesach itself were built around the fact that the Mitzrim had a particular and quite peculiar relationship with livestock and with sheep. Everybody in elementary school heard the fact that the Mitzrim worshipped sheep, that livestock were gods to the Mitzrim. Thus, when animals were dropping dead, and when the Jewish people tied a sheep to their bedpost, why was that such a big nisayon? Why is Pesach called Pesach, and the passing over the houses, and the blood on the doorpost? Why was blood on the doorpost such a big deal? Because it wasn't just a sheep. A sheep is not just a sheep. The sheep was the god for the Mitzrim. The sheep was something that the Mitzrim worshipped. Now, this is a classic example of two similar errors that we make when we learn things in elementary school. One of them is that we hear something when we're in third grade. It sort of makes sense to us then, and therefore we never think about it again with a sophisticated, critical eye to the things that we're learning. We accept that, yeah, everyone heard in third grade that the Mitzrim used to worship sheep, so everyone assumes that the Mitzrim worship sheep. The second mistake that we make is that we confuse people that we disagree with, people who might be Rishayim, with idiots. A Mitzri is stupider than a Jew. And therefore, we don't ask the incredibly obvious question. I believe strongly that the only people who could be comfortable with the idea of the Mitzrim worshipping a sheep are people who have never met a sheep in their lives. If you've ever spent any time whatsoever, if you've ever interacted with a cow, I mean, you have to be fairly dumb in order to worship a cow, in order to think that a cow is, and I know, historically, there are religions in the Far East, and maybe Mitzrayim was one of them. How is that even possible, though? How does a person have a brain on his shoulders? How does a person have any level of intelligence and come to the conclusion that this cow or that the sheep is a god? How is that possible? How could that even be? How could any person with any modicum of intelligence look at a sheep and treat it as if it were a god and treat it as if it was a deity? That really is, it's borderline bizarre. It makes absolutely, absolutely no sense. And Rav Steinsaltz explains so incredibly beautifully. Rav Steinsaltz says that the world is made up of sheep and shepherds. Listen to this idea and listen to its depth. For many, many people, not in ancient Egypt, and not people with low IQs, and not people who are not thinking people, and not people incapable of any sort of critical or important thought, for many, many people, including sitting here right now, they are more than happy to worship a god, but only a god that is a sheep. A sheep is something which follows its master, which follows the real boss. A sheep is a follower. So we're able to worship a god who is a sheep. But says Rav Steinsaltz, David HaMelech describes, we sing it every week at Shalosh Shudas, Hashem Ro'i Lo Echsar. The Jewish people do not worship sheep. They're not smarter or cooler because they know how to worship a god. The Jewish people, instead of worshiping a sheep, don't worship a god. They worship a shepherd. All people, the Mitzrim and the Jews alike, worship the god. The question was your god a sheep or was your god a shepherd? Is it a God from whom you take instruction or a God to whom you give instruction? Is it a God who conforms to our ideas of what should be? Or do we recognize the fact that our intellect is limited and that God has the ultimate truth and therefore we give of ourselves willingly and enthusiastically to God's infinite wisdom as expressed by God himself in the Torah and as expressed by God's chosen prophets and rabbis through Torah Shabbat Al Peh? That's the choice that a person makes. But many of us are not clinging to our own value of freedom, and as much as we are craving, like the ancient Mitzrim, we are desiring a God who is a sheep, a God who is going to tell us what we want to hear, and a God who tells us something we don't want to hear, we will ignore him and pretend that God never said it in the first place or that God didn't mean it. There is an enormous myth, and I'll tell you exactly how this idea of Rav Steinsaltz applies in our lives. There's an enormous, enormous myth. I believe, and I've mentioned this to many of the Madrichim in the past, I believe it might be the single greatest myth when it comes to high school education today, when it comes to the way that people deal with Judaism when they're in high school. And that is that, this is not the myth part yet, I don't really love learning, and the really reason why I don't love learning is because I find Gemara to be boring, I find Gemara to be difficult, but most importantly for our last couple of minutes here now, I find Gemara to be irrelevant. I don't find, if you teach me something that's relevant, Rabbi, can we learn a Masechta that's more relevant? Why do we have to spend all year learning about a sukkah? Why do we have to spend all year learning about a cow? Don't get me started on what a stupid argument that is, and many of your Madrichim have given great chaburas in years past explaining why every cow is a car and every rock is an iPad and all the other ideas that you have in Masechta's Bava Kama, which is anything but irrelevant. That's not for now. But you've all heard the argument. Many of us have said the argument. I would like learning, I'd like Judaism a lot more if it was relevant. And I'm going to call your bluff right now, because we're all friends, and because it's dark, and because I'm not looking anybody in the eye when I say this. The last thing in the world anybody here really wants is a Judaism that is relevant. A Judaism that is relevant is a Judaism that tells you, as many of you heard Rabbi Leibowitz just a few minutes ago, it's a Judaism that tells you that it matters what goes on your iPod, and that God has something to say about it. A Judaism that is relevant is a Judaism that has something to say who you spend your time with on a Friday afternoon in Yerushalayim and what you do with that person when you spend the time. That Judaism is available to you, but most of us don't want it. Because in Rav Steinsaltz's words, we'd rather have a God who is a sheep than a God who is a shepherd. We don't want to be told what to do. We are the apple that is growing and growing and growing to the point that it falls off the tree and it gains the independence that ultimately kills it. Nobody here is asking those questions. What does the Torah have to say about what I do on a Saturday night in November during my junior year in high school? What does the Torah have to say about what I watch on the internet, which sites I go to, and which sites I don't? Most of us are afraid to ask those questions. And that's not the Judaism we practice. It's not your rabbis, and it's not the Gemara Talmud Bavli that made Judaism irrelevant. It's us who made Gemara irrelevant. It's us who made Judaism irrelevant, because it is us, more often than not, who crave a religion where God is a sheep as opposed to God who is a shepherd. There is genius in the system that says, no, we are not the final arbiters of morality. God is. We are not the ones who decide what we should do. God does. Are we supposed to understand it? Are we supposed to love it? That's column A from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's decision. Of course we are. But are we supposed to define our Judaism by what appeals to us and what we like, as opposed to saying, no, there's more to Judaism. Judaism is answering or giving ourselves over to a higher authority. That's what it comes down to. I remember a conversation when I was in college. I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was and is a person who struggles deeply with belief. And we debated, this is not something that happened or happens to many people oftentimes in their lives, but this is it. We began a conversation about 11:30 at night, and it ended about 4:30 in the morning. We went at it for about 5 hours. If I'm not mistaken, I remember the end of the conversation. I don't remember much of the 5 hours. If I'm not mistaken, the conversation was about tefillah. This is one of my one of the smarter friends that I have. He destroyed me in the debate. It took 5 hours, but by the end, it was a clear winner. I did not have any good answers for his questions. So he said to me, after 5 hours, 4:30 in the morning, he said, so you don't have answers to my questions, correct? I said, I really don't. He said, I hope that means, I hope you're intellectually honest. He wasn't a Russia, he wasn't a Mises, he wasn't, you know, a terrible person, but he was passionate about this argument. He said, I hope that means you're not waking up in 3 hours to davening chakras. And I said, not only am I going to wake up in 3 hours to daven chakras, but it's going to be one of the best chakras that I've had in a very long time. Because it's going to be a shockless where it says, I may not understand everything. I may not have all the answers, but I'm going to keep on asking the questions. I'm going to keep on trying to understand them. And I'm going to understand that the definition of my Judaism, the Judaism that was introduced to the Jewish people of Mara, is a Judaism of incredible beauty. incredible things like Shabbos and civil law and how to interact with each other, but also the Judaism of Parah Aduma, which, by the way, it can't mean both, but I almost wish it could, is also the Judaism of Kibbutz Av Ve'Em for all the reasons that Rabbi Sabalevsky described. They're both correct, Kibbutz Av Ve'Em and Parah Aduma, in this very theme. And it's the Judaism of God as a shepherd, because God is my shepherd and He has instructed me to daven. I'm going to daven even on the day that I understand it the least, even on the day that I struggle, because that becomes part of the Judaism that I'm practicing. The Judaism that says that I answer and I believe in a higher authority. Does a person need independence to succeed in this world? Of course he does. One of the great things about NCSY Kollel or any summer camp experience is that you are away from the structure of school and even the incredibly beautiful and important structure of homes. That's how a person grows up. A person can't be needy and dependent on the supervision and authority of others his entire life. There needs to be degrees of independence. Of course we should celebrate the 4th of July. Of course we should say and sing proudly that we are the land of the free and the home of the brave. Bravery and freedom are values that we care about. Why not embrace William Wallace and say no to tyranny and stand up for a person's rights and say a life worth living? This is a value that might even be worth dying for. It's so critically important. But it is not the end all and be all of our existence. That independence, that creativity, that innovation, which God demands of us, is balanced by a strong sense of allegiance to a higher authority, of saying that I do not know everything. There is only one omniscient force in the world, and it is God. And God will ultimately determine my morality and my choices and my way of living. Just following orders and being brainwashed is never a good thing. And we could talk about what's the response to those things. Brainwashed means I don't think. I don't try to understand. I do things bypassing my brain. That's what brainwashed means. My brain is not involved in the process. And I will tell you, you can call me on it if you want. If you had the most inspirational summer, but you feel like you haven't thought in 6 weeks, you have failed here this summer. That's not what Judaism is. That's what being brainwashed is. You have a problem if your madrich or your rebbe has convinced you to put on tzitzis and you haven't thought about it for a minute. If you don't feel like being an hour-based medrash, or even being on our basketball courts, makes you think about things in a way that you never thought about them before. You're not supposed to just follow orders. You're supposed to challenge and to ask, and you're supposed to listen to it. But we're also the people of Na'aseh V'Nishma. We believe, if it comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if it comes from our Chazal, that there is an infinite wisdom that is greater and beyond us, and that's what we're trying to aspire to. That's what we're trying to do, and there's no reason for us not to be proud of it. Freedom is great, and freedom has its limits. Because God, who is our shepherd, Hashem Ro'i Lo Echsar, the God from whom I take direction, is the God who ultimately comforts us, is the God who ultimately provides meaning to our religious experience and to our religious lives, and it is the God that we serve so passionately all of the time. Let's go quickly in Daven Maariv in the Beis Medrash. Thank you very much for listening. All the chairs and extenders need to go back into the Beis Medrash right away.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you.